Welcome to Trilawyer Talk. I'm Scott Glovsky, and I'm your host for this podcast where we speak with some of the best trial lawyers in the United States. This is a storytelling podcast, so we simply have great lawyers tell great stories from cases that had a profound impact on them. First today, I want to mention that our hearts go out to everyone in Houston, and especially all of the great trial lawyers we've interviewed here in Trilawyer Talk, including Michael Callahan, Emily DeToto, Ron Estefan, Paula Elliott Estefan, Andy Vickery, and Eric Davis. We hope you're all safe and our thoughts and prayers are with you. Today, we're very fortunate to have a tremendous trial lawyer from Louisiana, Jody Amade. Jody was a former member of the Louisiana State Senate and is a tremendous spirit and a tremendous character. And he's going to tell us a story that I'm sure you'll find interesting. Let's get started. I'm very happy to be sitting with Jody Amade, who's a phenomenal lawyer from Louisiana, who practices in Gonzales, Louisiana, and is truly an amazing storyteller, an amazing lawyer, an amazing teacher. Jody, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Scott. I'm honored to be on your show.
Do you have a story that you can share with us from a case that had a significant impact on you?
Yeah, the last case that we tried, me and my law partner, Andre Gaucher, it was in Gonzales, and we had a client by the name of Randall, and he came see us, and he had been rear-ended pretty hard, and you know he was hurting, and so you know I said, well, Randall, you know, the people didn't have much insurance, but he decided to he'd get back with me, and about 8 months later he came back, and he had had a surgery. Come to find out, he was at work when he got rear-ended. He was in a work vehicle, so workers' comp paid for everything. And but there was only like, you know, $25,000 in insurance. And he just couldn't believe there was nothing he could do. So I said, well, let's check and see if they got UM coverage. So I did, and he did. They had a significant amount. And you know, he'd been working for his company for about 25 years. And he really struggled. It was a real internal struggle with him whether or not to make a claim. He was back at work. He had only after his neck surgery, he had only had three visits to the doctor after, you know, post-operative checkups. And he hadn't gone back to the doctor. He was doing pretty good. So he said, well, I'll get back with you. So in about a month, he came back in and decided that he wanted to go ahead and file a claim. So by now we're getting close to prescription, so we had to file a suit. So we did, and you know, he's one of these people that you never hear from him. He's never, you know, he doesn't bother people. He doesn't bother lawyers. He doesn't, you know, we'd have to call and check on him, make sure he was doing okay every few months. But, you know, as the case moved along, We started realizing that this would be a case we may have to try because the insurance, the UM carrier didn't want to pay him much, even though he had a fusion in his neck. And so we went ahead and started gearing up for trial, and it really we thought we knew the case. We thought we knew him, his wife. Andre had actually known him and his family for a long time.
Andre, your law partner?
Yeah, Andre Gaucher, yeah, my law partner. So we decided to, when we realized we were going to trial, and something we always do, we decided to psychodrama our client. So we got Don Clarkson down and scheduled a day for Randall and his wife, Gay, to come in.
Right, Don Clarkson, the psychodramatist.
The psychodramatist. He came, and he's just amazing. And been working with him for years and years, and you know, we didn't have a lot of witnesses in this case. So what we thought was we would have Randall and his wife, you know, let the wife tell the story of what this has done to him. But what we discovered in about 6 hours of psychodrama was that his wife Gay just was not going to be able to testify. You know, she's a simple, wonderful lady, but at the end of the day, between me and Andre and Don, I mean, really Don, we just all looked at each other and he said, "Y'all, I don't think this is going to work." So we had to start developing a way to get the entire story of him out to the jury through our client without any witnesses. I mean, we didn't have any other witness to call. As far as, you know, family members, coworkers, he didn't want to involve any people at work. Very, very conscientious about his job. It's really the only job he's had in his life. So we did a little more work with Randall that day. And then before we got to trial, we, of course, got him back in for a few hours, two or three different times, working on things, trying to get him to be able to paint a picture and tell a story and set the scene. And, you know, actually, we learned so much during the psychodrama.
Like what, for example?
Well, like laying on the operating table, describing how that felt, what was flashing in his head and his eyes, and what he felt, how he felt about that, what could go wrong, what kind of person he was, you know, what he thought people thought about him, what he thought about himself, how he grew up. I mean, just his whole life story. Because we had so much to work with, because he was just such a prince of a guy, and just a hard-working, you know, down to earth. You know, never went to college. Nobody in his family ever went to college. I mean, all those things just, I think, just made a difference. And we discovered all that in the psychodrama setting. And so we took that, and we tried to do, of course, our only other witness we had was the doctor. And we had another hurdle that we had to get over, and it was the fact that when we tried the case, it had been about 4 years. The case took a long time. It had been around 4 years since he had been to a doctor, because he had the surgery, had a visit a couple weeks later, maybe a month, and then the next month, and he had never gone back. And it wasn't that he wasn't hurting. It was just that's the kind of person he is. So we had to figure out a way to get that to the jury and have him feel it. And we just did that through psychodramatic methods with him on the stand in the direct exam.
How?
Well, we took him into present tense and put him in an operating room. We did scenes like that. I got him off of the stand and had him sitting in his truck when he got rear-ended and did a little scene on that in present tense. And he did a phenomenal job. And what was so amazing is when we started the psychodrama back when we were preparing, I didn't think he would even be able to do it. But with Don's, you know, persistence and talent that, you know, not many people in the world have, he was able to get him to where he could go to that place and get in the moment. And he basically stayed in the moment for 40 minutes on the stand, and it was just real powerful that what these tools did for just a guy that, you know, had never even heard of. I mean, it was bizarre. He looked at us like we were, I mean, he, what you mean now, you know, I mean, it happened, it's not happening, but he was able to make it happen, and it brought the courtroom alive, and it was really, we picked a jury in the morning. And we did openings at 1 o'clock. About 1:30, we put the doctor on the stand and probably took a break. 3 o'clock, we put Randall on the stand. And at 4:30, we were doing closings. We did it all in one day. And that's not easy. But, you know, with different, you know, how courts work. I mean, you got delays and people have to take bathroom breaks and so forth. But, you know, it was just a wonderful experience.
And what did you learn from this case?
Well, one thing I learned, which is an interesting side story, is we always get to the courthouse early, and we were loading our stuff into the courtroom. And on a little dolly, you know, we had several boxes. And I went out to the parking lot to bring my little dolly and put it in my truck. And as I walked back in, at the end of the hallway, there was I thought to be a potential juror sitting there reading a book. I mean, I looked at him. He had some, you know, kind of loose khaki pants on, just a light blue button-down shirt, tucked in, nice and neat, appeared to be about 50 years old with glasses. And I thought to myself, Lord, this guy must be an engineer, maybe a librarian. I don't know, but it doesn't look like the kind of juror we would want. You know, I was judging him, and which is not really good to do, as we know. I walked into the courtroom and I told Andre, I said, well, we got one we're probably not going to want on the jury. And he said, what are you talking about? I said, well, there's a librarian out there. You know, I just kind of nicknamed him the librarian. And so they come in and we start picking the jury, and first panel gets selected to be voir dired, and Andre does the panel and he's not on it. And I think we had about 8 jurors picked after that first panel. So then they put another panel. Now it's my turn. Well, lo and behold, here comes the librarian, and he's in the panel. And so in my mind, I'm looking at him saying, okay, well, he's surely going to, you know, we're not going to want him. And
he's surely going to screw us.
Oh yeah. He's going to screw us. I mean, we can't have him on this jury just by the way he looks. I mean, that's what we've all been conditioned to, just look at people and judge them. And valuable lesson for me, because we got down to it and I knew how many strikes we had, and I knew how many the defense had, and I knew they wasn't going to use a strike on him. And they had some other people that I thought, once I finished, and I knew this guy was probably going to end up on the jury. And he did. And of course, during the voir dire, you know, when I started sharing things about myself, and then he started sharing things about himself, it didn't appear to be that bad.
What did you share about yourself?
Well, I just shared that, you know, I think one of the things I talked about was lawyers and verdicts and my fear of people that are conservative, because there's something in me that, you know, I don't like some lawyers, you know. I don't like the same things other people don't like. I don't like my rates going up, my insurance rates going up. I don't like frivolous lawsuits, okay? And I shared those types of things. And by doing that, I think it helped me, it helped him talk, and everyone that was there, it went great. And we get to the end of the trial, he's on the jury, and the jury walks out of the deliberation room with the verdict. And then I don't know if you know in Louisiana, but the jury foreman or foreperson, they fill out the verdict form and they sign it and they hold it in their hand and they don't give it to the bailiff and they get in the box with it, and then the bailiff, the judge will instruct the bailiff to get it and bring it to the clerk, and he had the verdict form in his hand. I'm like, oh Lord, what's going to happen now? And it was just a real valuable lesson that I learned, and I'm glad I learned it. And, you know, we talk about that all the time, about, you know, you don't want to, when you're picking a jury, you don't want to look for people to kick off. You want to build a tribe, and you want to make everybody, you know, pull everybody in. And I mean, that's what we ended up doing. But in my mind, before we started, I judged a person, and I was just absolutely wrong.
So in the end, he was on your side?
Yes. He was the foreman, and he was one of the, from what I hear, the cheerleaders in the back. You know, he really connected to Randall. And so, you know, it was just, I told someone one, I'm going to write a book one day and I'm going to name it The Librarian. It just really stuck in my mind, you know.
How did you connect in that case with your client, Randall?
I think I connected because, you know, we have a lot of similarities, you know, during our psychodramas and such with him, you know, I really became close with him, to where I tried to put myself in his shoes and feel how he feels because of who he is and the life that he's had. He's never been a guy that's really ever really gotten ahead, you know. He's just the kind of guy that touches your heart, and somehow we connected from an early. I mean, you I'm not going to take credit for it. That's the kind of guy he is. I mean, everybody wants to help him, and he's the kind of guy that we learned, actually some of it from his wife. He just always wants to help. He never worried about himself, and it was just a valuable, I guess, lesson that I learned.
Where did you identify with him?
I guess I identified mostly with him because they were, you know, the insurance company, they treated him like a second-rate human being, in my opinion. You know, we all know what neck surgeries are worth, and or at least a range. And, I mean, they wasn't even at the low end of the range. They were like, you from Sorrento or whatever, you from Gonzales, or, you know, we're not paying you. And I think I connected to that because, you know, growing up, I was never the favorite. You know, I wasn't, you know, my family, you know, I wasn't really supposed to go to college or be a lawyer. You know, there's no other lawyers. And I was always felt like I was the underdog. And I was never, you know, I played sports, played baseball, even in college, and I was never the biggest guy. I was never the fastest guy. You know, the scouts wasn't looking at me. I always had to work harder than the next guy to perform, you know. And I think, in a way, that's how I felt about Randall. That's how his life has been. He's been, you know, he's never gotten a big job that pays a bunch of money. He's just always been content with being who he is. And that's, I think that's how I connected with him. From that aspect, just you know, I've never been the favorite. I you know, when I got out of law school, I mean, heck, I wanted to be in the Rotary Club. I wanted to do this. Well, nobody asked me to be in the Rotary Club. Nobody asked me to be in the whatever club. And I'm just saying Rotary Club. I'm not talking bad about the Rotary. I'm just using that as an example. But, you know, we had to fight. Our law firm, we just had two people that basically we started with nothing. And if I had to fight and fight and fight in years and years, and only recently do people even look at us as good lawyers, maybe. I mean, maybe they know we're good lawyers, but we certainly not the you know what I'm talking about, the ones with the windows and the glass around their building, you know, in the big cities, and you know, they don't, you know, they, I guess, these big corporations, the way they look at us is like we're from, you know, little podunk people from Louisiana, and I actually kind of like it. So I'd rather be the underdog and just have to fight our way to the top.
And how does that feel? In other words, to have to fight and fight and fight and fight.
Well, it actually motivates me. It makes me feel like I have something to prove every time. Now, of course, as you know, sometimes, you know, you don't have to go fight. Sometimes you can settle cases, but you know, people in general, lawyers are scared to go try cases, and that's one thing we decided at an early age years ago that we're just going to go try, and when we fail, but we have to go fight for the clients, and that's you know, it really motivates me, and it makes me feel like I want to fight.
And this sense of not being acknowledged, being the underdog, and not feeling connected or accepted, where does that come from in Jody's life?
I don't know. I guess at a young age, and it's kind of strange, but I was always accepted as far as, you know, socially. I've always been blessed to have friends, like a lot of friends. But as far as in business and in the legal profession, I don't really feel like, I don't know. I've always felt like we were frowned upon, you know, because we were plaintiff lawyers in a little small town, and we didn't have a big building, and we didn't wear suits to work every day. And, you know, my favorite story is I still to this day go to lunch. You know, we wear blue jeans most of the time. And I go to lunch, and people still tell me after 20 years, well, oh, man, y'all off today? I'm like, no, we're not off. I mean, we just, you know, and so, you know, I don't have to, you know, I just, I don't, I really don't want to wear a suit every day. And maybe that's part of it, because we never did, and people always, I know some of the older lawyers are frowned on it, but, you know, when I meet with my clients, and I've asked them at the end of the day, like after the case is over, I mean, I've asked 50 of them, 100 of them, and a lot of them, most of them, almost 99% of them will tell you, I feel way more comfortable just being yourself, not trying to wear a costume to work, because, I mean, you know, not that it's bad to do it, but, you know, I've just never been to country, we're not country club lawyers, you know, and I think that people, and I guess it can work both ways, but some people, you know, they just think, they probably feel like we're just not as good as those other lawyers. But, I mean, I guess the results speak for themselves at this point, but for years and years, I don't think people really wanted to acknowledge us as real trial lawyers. You know, they make fun of you know, the way we do things. We're the only people that do it like we do it around where we are, you know. We pick juries different. We examine witnesses. We do things different. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think what we're doing and what we're learning and the way we try and connect with our clients and our juries is what really helps people. And that's the only way you can help them, is if you can connect them with the jury. So I'm perfectly at peace with the methods that we use.
A couple of minutes ago, you mentioned some of my favorite stories. I know you've got amazing stories. Can you share one with us?
About a trial?
About anything.
Trying to think. I guess most of my funny stories involve my law partner, it seems like, with trying cases. But we had a case one time where we were suing Home Depot. A bag of sand had fell off of the top shelf, and it fell on the back, not on top of our client's head, but it hit him kind of at the bottom of his neck and his shoulder. I mean, it fell from about 10 feet. He was fooling with some sand on the lower hat, on the floor, and apparently the rack, you know, the racks they got in Home Depot, it may have shook it and had a sandbag just leaning over the edge, and it hit him. So we in trial in Baton Rouge, and we young lawyers, this is 15 years ago, and so we had an expert in, Dr. Larks, out of Houston, Texas. He's a former NASA scientist, or I think he was an astronaut, but he didn't really go on any missions, but he's a safety expert. So he comes into town, and we're going to take him to eat. And so we go eat some seafood right there in Gonzales. He wanted some fried seafood the night before he was to testify. And he asked us, we were eating, and he said, guys, and he was an older gentleman. He said, y'all young fellas want to take me to this store? So when they put me on the stand tomorrow, the first thing they're going to ask me if I ever walked in that store, and I don't want to have to, at least I can tell them, yeah, I did it last night, but it won't be no, never. So we said, well, sure, Doc, we'll bring you in there. So we pulled on up to Baton Rouge and went into the Home Depot where it happened. And so we walking around, me and Andre and him. And next thing you know, Dr. Larks, he pulls out a camera and starts, a Polaroid, and starts taking pictures. We said, well, Doc, I don't know if you'll be taking pictures. You know, we don't. Well, the someone reported him, or us, not him, us, we were with him, to the store manager. So next thing you know, they done called the police, the store manager's coming, the head of security's coming, and they literally chasing us, and we trying to get out the store. And then they met us at the door, and they didn't want to let us out, and they were demanding, they were trying to take the camera from Dr. Larks. And Andre, my law partner, grabs the camera and he takes it from our expert and says, no, you're not getting this camera. He sticks it in his pocket, and he didn't push the guy out of the way, but he kind of went around him and got the door open and let the doctor out, and we went to the car, and they were literally chased us all the way to the car wanting to try and get the camera. And so when we get in the car with him, and he He's sitting in that front seat, and I'm driving. And I'm driving, and the guy's trying to – won't let me shut the door. And I got to, like, take off with him trying to get me not to go. And of course, Andre's taking charge of the whole scene, you know, saying, you better get out my way. And, you know, it was – it wasn't real – it really wasn't funny at the time. So we leave there, and we go to bring Dr. Larks back to his room and to the hotel. And, man, he gets out the car, and we look at each other and said, oh, my God, what's going to happen with this? I mean, are they going to file a police report, get arrested? I mean, what's going to happen? And so we didn't do anything. We went to the trial the next day, and, of course, they get him on cross. And they had him on cross, and they said, well, have you ever been to the store? And he said, well, yeah, I went last night. And he said, yeah, you went with your lawyers, huh? And he said, well, they're not my lawyers. They're the lawyers for the client. And they made a big deal about it. And so, you know, it was just a scary deal. And they tried to get the court to, you know, sanction us or whatever, because we went. But, I mean, it's a public place. We went in it. Now, the funny part is I went back to that store a couple months later, and there is a sign in there that says no photography or video. So I guess it is a store rule, but it was one of the most bizarre scenes I've ever seen because, you know, I'm in the middle of a trial. I mean, we'd already started the trial, and he had flown in for like day three, and we had finished 2 days of trial. I'm in the trial, and I got my expert in that store, you know, apparently according to them violating some rule or something, but it all worked out in the end. So it's just a story that we tell all the time, you know.
Well, that's awesome. Well, Jody, lastly, I get a lot of emails and calls from young lawyers asking for advice and what they can do to become better lawyers. What advice do you have for them?
Well, I think, you know, that's a great question, Scott. I think one of the things that I've always told people, and I don't know where I learned it, I probably learned it at the Trial Lawyers College, is, you know, 18 years ago when I started this journey, is, you know, don't run around worrying about how much money you're going to make. Waste your time running around worrying about how you're going to help people and how you're going to change a life. And that's the first thing. And if you do that, it spreads like wildfire. You know, if you just worry about getting justice, everything else is going to be fine. And the other thing is that I think young lawyers, when they get out of law school, they have no idea what it is to be a human anymore. I know I didn't. And they need to find a way to do it, whether it's through psychodrama, coming to the Trial Lawyers College, going to a regional seminar is a wonderful idea. It doesn't cost much. They got plenty of scholarships. I'm not trying to promote it, but I am, I guess. And, you know, it's probably not the only way, but it's my way. It's how I did it. And so that's two things. You know, the money part, because I see so many young lawyers, they, you got a lawyer doing a divorce, and the client pays them, and then they don't want to finish divorce because they owe them a couple $100. You know, I mean, that's just crazy that people treat others like that. I mean, sure, you got to get paid, but, you know, there comes a time when you got to just help people, and I've done my share of all that, and even in personal injury cases. I mean, I see so many lawyers settle cases because they're just, you know, hurrying up and settling them for 50, 60, 70 cents on a dollar, rather than waiting and taking their time and getting what they deserve for their client. But they're thinking about themselves and not their clients. And the only way I know to do that is do a lot of personal exploration. And so I guess that's my advice I would give a young lawyer. Just the same advice as I'd give a kid that's not a lawyer. So, you know, I think it works in life in general.
Jody, thanks so much for being with us. I really appreciate you taking the time to share with us today.
Well, thank you, Scott, and thank you for the wonderful job you do.
Thank you for joining us today for Trial Lawyer Talk. If you like the show, I'd really appreciate it if you could give us a good review on iTunes, and I'd love to get your feedback. You can reach me at www.scottglovsky.com. That's scottglovsky.com. And I'd love to hear your feedback. You can also check out the book that I published called Fighting Health Insurance Denials, A Primer for Lawyers. That's on Amazon. I put the book together based on 20 years of suing health insurance companies for denying medical care to people, and it provides a general outline of how to fight health insurance denials. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you in the next episode.